One of the things that literature, great literature, teaches us and acts as a warning to us is as a Cassandra, the Greek myth, right? The prophetess who said things and then no one listened. We can listen to the Cassandras and then we can take from them and we can say, okay, I don't want to go down that road, because we still have free will, despite what the technologists would tell us. We still have free will and we still have choice. At the end of the day, you can still decide to hug a child rather than to hit it. You can choose to help your neighbor and build a community with them rather than ignore them. That is your choice. Bill Gates isn't mediating that. Jeff Bezos isn't mediating that. Elon Musk isn't mediating that. You're doing that. You're in charge. And our classics teach us that.
Hello and welcome to the Leadership Launchpad, where we help technical managers improve themselves, their teams, and their organizations. On this show, I talk with industry leaders, coaches, authors, and experts to help give you actionable insights to improve your own performance and the performance of those around you. Our guest today is Hasan Sorels. Hasan is a leadership consultant and coach at his firm Leadership Toolbox. He is the host of the Leadership Lessons from the Great Books podcast. I first met Hasan several months ago, and I was really captivated by these really long form, deep dive discussions that he has about classic literature and taking lessons from those books and applying them to today. In this discussion, we touch on where the concepts of leadership originally came from in literature, why so many of the challenges you face as a leader are features of the human condition, not bugs, and what you can learn about networking by reading War and Peace. It's a really fun discussion. We touch on a lot of topics, so I really hope you enjoy it. But before we get into that discussion, I do want to remind you to make sure you are subscribed to this podcast if this is your first time listening to the show. And if you're already subscribed, then I would ask that you share this show with at least one other person, because that, after all, is how we grow. I can't tell you how much it means to me. So with that, let's get into the discussion with Hasan Sorels. Hasan, welcome to the Leadership Launchpad. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. It's been a while since we first chatted. We had an excellent conversation after we first got introduced, so I'm really excited to have another one with you. And I want to start with the obvious, because you do a lot of, you know, you have a podcast on, you know, lessons from the great books. And I don't know. I thought the classics were dead. Like my mom, she actually used to work at a liberal arts college, and that liberal arts college is struggling to get people in. Nobody takes a liberal arts education anymore. Mm-hmm. What can people learn from reading some of these classics, the great books of literature? What can they teach us about leadership?
Well, to paraphrase from the late great Samuel Clemens, aka Mark Twain, which he was paraphrasing from somebody else, and then was paraphrased by someone else. The death of the classics has been greatly exaggerated.
Yes, always.
We've been actually trumpeting the death of the classics for probably about the last 200 years.
Interesting.
In our country. So when you look at sort of where leadership comes from, right, and how we conceptualize leadership, one of the challenges of looking at that as a topic is everyone knows what leadership is when it's good and when it's working.
Sure.
And everybody really knows what it isn't and what it is when it's bad or it's missing, right?
Yeah.
And we have struggled for many years, thousands of years, actually, because the understanding of leadership goes all the way back, I would say, to the Bible. But others would say to Marcus Aurelius and Meditations. Yeah. Okay, whichever one you want to pick, that's fine.
Yeah.
But understanding how and what are the dynamics that cause people to follow and allow people to lead is something that is it involves multiple layers and operates in multiple different vectors.
Yeah.
Inside of a person's mind, but also interpersonally between the leader and the follower. There's this idea of emotional exchange that occurs between a leader and a follower. Now, because we live in a mechanistic and scientific age, a technological age, we reduce all of those pieces down to mechanistic parts. And this is where you get the psychology of leadership or the behavioral science behind leadership. But there's a lot of areas that science cannot touch, right? Such as love or envy or pride. There's been no scientific study on pride, well, at least not one that I'm aware of. And if your listeners know of one, they should probably send me the link. I would love to read that. There's no scientific study on envy. There's no scientific study on those kinds of deep emotional reactions and responses. And so how does a leader understand those? Well, the best way to understand those, at least historically, has been through the classics, through Shakespeare, through Milton, through Austin, through, in the 20th century, Hemingway, or even the writings of someone like Zora Neale Hurston, right? Or Maya Angelou, right? Writing encapsulates in very meaningful ways for readers and parks those meanings inside of readers' minds and then allows them to access understanding of how to lead others from that that avatar carrying technology that we call a book, right? And, you know, look, I realize that we live in a post-literate age. We are now in the age of video. In particular, we are in the age of 60-second and 30-second video. And, you know, look, there's still nothing as impactful as a book.
I mean, well, and, you know, to kind of, you know, walk back through some of what you just said, you know, just as you ended there of we're in the age of 30 and 60 second video, yet we are in an age where the most popular podcast on the planet regularly goes over 3 hours in length. You know, we had, you know, recently there was a YouTube review of, or a 4 hour YouTube breakdown of why the Disneyland or Disney World Star Wars hotel failed. And 9 million people watched that 4 hour long breakdown. People still want that connection. They still want the details. They want to immerse themselves. And I think you're totally right in that literature does provide us that avenue. It, like, it gives us that, that ability to put ourselves in a position of somebody else and really like sit with it, because, you know, I always think it's interesting, you know, and this is, you know, again, walking kind of through some of the things that you said at the very beginning of talking about how, you know, the history of understanding leadership and human connection. I'm a big believer in that, you know, the defining characteristic of human beings is our ability to bring large groups of people together and organize them in order to accomplish goals. And the ability to do that, how you do that, is like the defining problem of humanity, right? And so it makes sense that the early, some of the earliest writings would be about that, this kind of stuff, and which is why we can't ignore thousands of years of written word.
Not only can't we ignore it, I fundamentally believe that in our attempts to, and again, I want to go back to this idea of mechanization. You know, I know about your background. I know where you where you work and your focus. And I have no objection. I want to be very clear. I have no objection to science and engineering. Science and engineering brought us this podcast. It's done amazing things over the last 100 years. It got us to the moon, but it also got us Facebook. Okay, great, cool. No problem with science and engineering. One of the challenges that we have, though, with a mechanistic mindset is that we believe that the problems of leading people in particular and the problems of humanity in general, we begin to fall into the abyss of the belief that with our scientific thinking, we begin to fall into the abyss of the belief that these types of problems are merely bugs that can be worked out of the system.
Interesting.
Versus being features that are actually part of the human condition. So love is a feature that is a part of the human condition. Envy might very well be a feature of the human condition. Desire, I'm going to use an old school term here, covetousness of something that somebody else has, right? Very old school term from another hoary old book that defies the algorithm, right?
Yeah.
And these things cannot be, they can be algorithmically manipulated, but they cannot be algorithmically eliminated because they are features of the system, not bugs. Mm-hmm. And this is where you get very smart people like Yuval Noah Harari, and others who talk in very messianic terms about the end of human beings. But the reality is, and I hate to tell folks like that, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but there is no, at least not utilizing purely mechanistic terms and purely mechanistic systems, we will not evolve past our features. That is utopian thinking. And by the way, many classical writers have explored the idea, in particular classical science fiction writers like Robert Heinlein and Philip K. Dick. He of, you know, the story that lies underneath Blade Runner, you know, the movie Blade Runner, have explored this idea of what would happen if we went past ourselves. Yeah. And it is a horror because guess what? Those things are features, not bugs.
Yeah.
And so the challenge of leadership, which you said has existed historically and will always exist off into the future, needs to be met by something that has I think stood the test of time. And that is the classics.
Yeah.
We will still be reading Shakespeare no matter what else happens globally or in the United States politically. We will be reading Shakespeare in 500 years. We will be reading The Tempest. We will be reading Macbeth. We will be reading Midsummer Night's Dream. We will be reading, in order to understand government, we will be reading Richard III. We will be reading Hamlet.
Yeah.
Those things will be happening.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you, so often when you go back and read some of this, some of these classics, and you go back and read Meditations, you know, it could be written today.
Yeah.
It's so incredible just how, you know, as much as we always want to claim that our time is unique and special, the human experience is so transcendent over everything else that has changed over the last thousands of years that when talking about that kind of, this kind of stuff, somebody speaking 3,000 years ago can be just as relevant as someone speaking 3 minutes ago. Because it's such a true experience. You have your, you know, you are much deeper into this than I am through your podcast, through your discussions. Let's ground this a little bit of, do you have any like really like favorite examples or examples of, you know, from books or clear lessons that you think can be drawn?
Oh yeah. So I'll pull one that came from a recent episode that we did around just the first few chapters of War and Peace. Massive book, right?
Very big book.
you know, Leo Tolstoy's magnum opus, right? Yeah. it comes in, I mean, my copy, I think, came in at something like 1,400 pages with annotations and bibliography. I mean, it's a beast.
Yeah.
And just the first chapters of War and Peace are about how, are a case study in how a leader should network.
Interesting. Okay.
They're a case study in how a leader should approach a networking event where they don't know anyone, where they should approach the rotating interpersonal relationships that are going on in the room, where how they should position themselves in relation to the men and the women in the room. They are also, it is also a case study in how a leader should structure the nature of their questions, their approach to the host, how not to be overbearing, how not to be too much of a wallflower, how to hit that delicate balance that we try to teach young business leaders, startup founders, folks who maybe are coming from more of an employee background and now have to pitch their own thing and are walking into a room where they have imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Guess what? Leo Tolstoy wrote about imposter syndrome in the first few chapters of War and Peace. And so that's the most recent example. And so far our most downloaded episode this year to date. But we've had multiple episodes where we've explored these sort of transcendent ideas. I love how you use that term, transcendent. These sort of transcendent ideas and brought them down to very commonality.
Yeah.
So another episode, we talked about Miyamoto Musashi's A Book of Five Rings, which seems like a book just really focused around martial arts and war and all this. But in reality, it's a book that encompasses almost every piece of the human interaction that a leader can have with a follower, and increasingly that a leader can have with themselves.
Yeah.
Right. So when a leader looks into or stares into the abyss of themselves, what do they pull out? What do they find in there? And if there's nothing in there, Miyamoto Musashi asserts that then you have not done the hard work of becoming a warrior on the biggest enemy that you have, which is your own self.
Yeah. These are great. I really love the War and Peace one too, because it's such an example of not just how this is good information for, like, it's not just high, lofty, big picture ideas. It's practical stuff. It's like how to network, you know. And you gotta be looking for it. One thing, since you mentioned, you know, some of these classics can tend to be a little bit long. There's obviously a big movement out there. Lots of stuff happening around shortening things, you know, whether, you know, it's always existed with Cliff's Notes, and, you know, it's just continued to go farther and farther from there. I have my own thoughts on this. I've never been able to connect with a lot of these apps and a lot of these things that shorten things. What do you think people miss in, I guess, like synopses?
So it's interesting you asking me this question, because you started off with talking about a 4-hour long podcast about, you know, a particular thing, right? Or one of the more popular podcasts on the planet right now, that gentleman, and you and I both know who he is, you know, will have 3- and 4-hour long conversations. Yeah. My most downloaded episode in the last 2.5 years that I've been doing this, getting ready to be 3, has been a 4-hour long, the 4-hour long, you know, Musashi episode, right? So I think that there's two dynamics happening at the same time, because you can't deny the long form, right?
Yeah.
But you also can't deny the short form, right? Yeah. And so I think the tension in a, and we don't have to talk about this, but the tension in a creator is, what kind of audience do you want?
Yeah.
And what kind of attention span do you want to grow? Right. Yeah. And so, I know you have your, you said you had your own thoughts, Matt. I have my own thoughts on these shortening apps, like, and I won't say any names, but these shortening apps, I've looked at some of them. Some of them are fine. I see what they're doing. The purpose of the system is to do what it's designed to do. So I get it.
Yeah.
But I personally am mounting a forward attack against all that.
I like it. Yeah.
And I'm not asking anybody else to join me in this war. I understand there's maybe some other folks who are out there. But I believe in having, I'll frame it this way. I don't believe that any of these kinds of discussions can really be distilled down into even a 30-minute. I think you have to let them breathe, and you have to let them explore, right? So I'll use a perfect example. Recently, in the month of July, we typically tend to cover on the podcast the nation state papers of the United States. So Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. Awesome. By the way, I think the Declaration of Independence stands as a piece of classical writing that will be read and will be referenced by governments, even not our own, for the next 500 years.
Absolutely.
Because it's insanely brilliant that Thomas Jefferson was able to write this at 32. It's nuts.
Yeah.
It's just nuts. He understood something about the human condition that went all up away, all up and down the hierarchy. And laid it out very clearly. Now, you can talk about the middle parts of it, you know, maybe being a little bit muddy, but the beginning and the end, I mean, boom, he nails it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like Michelangelo carving the Pietà at like 23 or 25 or whenever he did that, or Citizen Kane being made by Orson Welles when he was 26. Like, where does that come from?
It's incredible.
It's nuts. And so when you look at the nation state papers of the United States, what you see is a couple of different options. You can either ground them in contemporary culture and contemporary things that are happening right now, or you can ground them in the eternal and the transcendent, or you can do both at the same time in a conversation, right? And we've done both. We've both grounded them contemporarily, but we've also tried to make the conversation more transcendent. Mm-hmm. That's the value of having a longer form type of conversation versus a shorter form kind of one. And by the way, what the internet has shown us in general, what this piece of technology has shown us, is that this will be for some people, mm-hmm. but then for others, it will not.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's okay.
Yes. 100%. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Seth Godin, always talks mm-hmm. about that, where he's always just like, right. look, if you hate it, this wasn't for you. That's fine. Yeah, I think for me personally, I find it really interesting in this space now where, you know, we're building artificial intelligence and all this mm-hmm. stuff. And I think it's teaching us a lot about how the brain works. And I just always think of the brain as the greatest pattern matching machine that's ever existed. And there's something about just sitting in a subject for a long time, not having anybody point out the high points or, oh, this is the foot stomp or this is the key lesson, and just letting it stew in your brain. The biggest leaps I have ever made in my understanding of a subject were when I would take about a month and I would say, okay, I'm going to learn about this one thing. And I would pick three books from three different authors about that thing. And I would read them all in rapid succession during that month. Mm-hmm. And then I would also find podcast episodes or interviews with those mm-hmm. three authors. So it would be like mm-hmm. for several weeks, my brain is just stewing in this mm-hmm. one subject. And out the other end of it, just come all of these insights and all of these like amazing things as my brain is just like plugging away at it. It's not a conscious thing. It's a purely unconscious thing. That's where all these connections are being mm-hmm. made. And yeah, I think that, at least for me, from my perspective, I think you're 100% right. Different audiences, different people, it works in different ways. But for me, I think that kind of getting lost for a little while in the words is mm-hmm. where a lot of the value comes from to draw those true lessons.
It is the difference between a person who is literate and a person who is, and this is not an insult, a person who is illiterate, right? Hmm. And so I don't mean illiterate as in you cannot read the words.
Hmm.
I mean illiterate as in the comprehension of the things underneath or the patience to attain the comprehension underneath.
Yeah.
This isn't there or hasn't yes. been developed, right? Yes. It's like a muscle that you yes. haven't developed. Yeah. You got to go to the
yeah.
gym.
Yeah.
You've got to go do your reps,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And I love the people, I do martial arts, I go to the gym. I love the people who say, I can't go to the gym before I'm in shape.
Yeah. yeah.
Well, I see plenty of out of shape people at the gym and they're doing fine.
Yeah.
They're in the gym, yeah. right? So what the internet has done and what these applications that we built on top of the internet have done for us is they have allowed us to have the capacity to go into the gym. And again, to bring back Seth Godin for just a moment, when everybody has the opportunity to create, everybody has the opportunity to engage, well, almost everybody will.
Yeah.
But there will also be, and this is the dark side of this, there will also be a bunch of people who won't participate. Mm. And the challenge of leadership, of course, just to bring it back a little bit to this, is that you have to figure out how to lead all those kinds of people, because you can't yeah. just be a leader for one yeah. set of people or another yeah. set of people. You got to be a leader for all the people that are tasked with being on your team.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And yeah. And then again, to bring it back to literature, that's one of the benefits that you get is you can see all these different angles. You can interact with all exactly. these different characters to help to understand how, because yeah, leadership is, it's about expanding your repertoire of what you do and how you act to mold yourself to what other people need. I want to shift a little bit because mm-hmm. in our last discussion, we chatted a little bit about kind of, I think I used the metaphor of like shifting gears as a world mm-hmm. of where yeah. there's lots, I don't think anybody is going to deny that there's lots of change happening. As much as the human experience is this consistent thing that runs across time, there's always these changes. I'll bring up a phrase of the fourth turning. We don't need to go into mm-hmm. that, but just like there's lots of discussion out there. Ray Dalio yeah. has a recent book about this as well, about we're in this phase where clearly things are changing. And you can mark it, whether it was marking it at the beginning of like, whether it was the financial crisis or 9/11 or mm-hmm. The pandemic, all these different things have been happening. I'd love to know, I'm specifically interested in what kind of changes you're seeing. And then at the end, I'll make sure we get back to this idea of for leaders. What is this new world that you're seeing going to mean for leaders, and how are they going to have to be a little bit different?
So I turned 21, 13 days after September 11th, 2001. And I'm not the only one here. For people who were born in the year 1979, which is the year I was born in, or 1978, we'll take those folks too. They're fine folks. For folks who were born in those couple of years, literally the last 23, getting ready to be 24, 25 years have been nothing but chaos.
Yeah.
Financial chaos, social chaos, cultural chaos. Have there been moments of down moments in there where it seemed like things were going to be okay? Sure. But then you're swinging right back into chaos. As a matter of fact, as of the time of this recording, we've just come through probably the most chaotic month in presidential history in the last 40 years.
Absolutely.
Right? Just insane chaos, right? And by insane, I only mean we weren't alive to experience this last level of insanity.
Yeah.
So we have no marker or benchmark to describe it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you combine that with what I consider to be the 150-year-long project, in the West anyway, of deconstructionism and nihilism as a replacement for Christianity and public Christianity, and giving people the opportunity to engage in constructing their own, to paraphrase from Nietzsche, their own supermen. And now people are realizing that you can't really do that out of your own self psychologically. Yeah. It's really hard and you need a grounding. But if you take the grounding out, then what are you going to replace it with? Like we're in this existential struggle now, which is why the Stoics have returned for some folks. Right.
Sure.
Because you actually can't construct your own values out of your own self. It's really, really hard. And almost nobody does it. Much less does it well. Okay. So we've got that entire stew. And we also have technology. And our technologies are so much better now than they ever were. And yet, we seem to have hit the ceiling of actual human wisdom. Mm. We know how to, we know, you mentioned AI. We understand how the brain works, understand AI. But we don't really understand that much about how to apply it with wisdom or how to not apply it with wisdom.
Yeah.
So we seem to have hit the ceiling on human wisdom, and yet our human knowledge seems to have increased exponentially on the J curve.
Interesting.
A lot of interesting things happening all at once. So the fourth turning is about historical cycles. I'll be very brief.
Yeah.
There are four historical cycles. There's a high, there's an awakening, there's an unraveling, and then there's a crisis period, right? Roughly, if we patch from the end of World War II to now, a high period would have been right after World War II.
Yeah.
An awakening period would have been the hippies and the baby boomers. An unraveling period would have been the 80s and 90s. And then the crisis period started, I think it started with September 11th. Other folks say with the financial crisis of 2008. You could take your
pick.
But a crisis period historically in the West, and we've, by the way, traced this across 500 years in the West. And by the way, this is now expanding globally. Typically, a crisis period is resolved via a war of some kind. Civil war, world war, where things just sort of snap together. Yeah. And by the way, spiritually and existentially, I think people can feel this. And we don't want it, but we don't know how to avoid that. Values, differences, ideological differences, separation, all kinds of things happening just specifically in the United States, but also globally. Okay. What do the classics have to teach us about this? Well, the classics have to teach us that these cycles have always occurred. And that maybe the idea of historical progress being a never-ending line going forward might not necessarily be true. And so it pulls up as a caution to us. It acts as a backstop on our, I'm going to use an old school word here, hubris.
Yeah.
And our narcissism.
I always say, Rome forgot how to build roads.
Bingo. That's right.
It doesn't all go one direction.
It doesn't all go one direction. Well, or even in our day, the bureaucrats who are in charge of the roads have forgotten that their point is to be in charge of the road.
Sure.
Not to be sitting in the bureaucratic seat. But anyway. Yeah. The classics can teach us that humility. It can teach us that ability to recognize the cycles. Now, how do I see this resolving? Well, on my podcast, I've been saying for about the last year that we're done with this. We're almost at the end of the crisis cycle. No matter what insanity happens day to day in your newspaper headlines that flash across your phone, we are all, I think, historically, spiritually, people are deciding, and we're not actually talking about it out loud. We're just sort of all wandering in one direction together. Mm-hmm. We're getting ready to have a click sound. And I think a couple of things, I'm seeing a couple of precursor things happening politically, legally, socially, culturally, where I'm seeing people starting to go, oh, wait, it doesn't have to be like this. We don't have to go down the road of this crisis thing. Mm-hmm. Click, 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 click. And you get enough of those clicks going, and then all of a sudden it's resolved, right?
Okay.
Does that mean that warfare cannot happen? No. Does that mean that we shouldn't be on call or cautious for it? No. But it does mean that it is not an inevitability.
Yeah.
One of the things that literature, great literature, teaches us and acts as a warning to us is as a Cassandra.
Yeah.
The Greek myth, right? The prophetess who said things and then no one listened. We can listen to the Cassandras and then we can take from them and we can say, okay, I don't want to go down that road, because we still have free will, despite what the technologists would tell us. We still have free will and we still have choice.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you can still decide to hug a child rather than to hit it. You can choose to help your neighbor and build a community with them rather than ignore them. Yeah. That is your choice. Bill Gates isn't mediating that. Jeff Bezos isn't mediating that. Elon Musk isn't mediating that. You're doing that.
Yeah.
You're in charge. And our classics teach us that.
Yeah. Well, and I love kind of, thank you for kind of walking through that, because I do think, to use the point that you mentioned kind of at the very beginning of like this, the pace of these cycles, is the difficulty is a lot of, though these things like this have happened before, they happened before certainly like people our age's living memory, and in some cases anyone's living memory.
Correct.
And that's where these classics can be brought back in. Literature can be so helpful, because it gives you that chance to not just study it from a factual historical perspective of, oh, I know these things happened and I know, you know, Rome fell apart, but I can read things that were written by the people who were alive then and wrote stories about it. So I can really understand kind of more how it feels. And then that can help inform how I'm going to be behaving today. Of, oh, this has happened several times before. These are the things that worked for the people that were writing things down that we still remember. Maybe I can apply these to my life today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and one other point to add on top of that, I know we've got around the corner here. We live in a time where we have more access to more pure information than at any point in time in humanity.
Yeah.
The Greeks would be shocked by how much information we have access to.
Yeah.
I think if Aristotle could be on Twitter, he'd be stunned into silence. Thomas Jefferson would tweet at people. I absolutely believe he would. He would have loved Twitter. Oh my, X. He would have loved all of that. And he would have been like sicking people against each other and gaslighting, because that guy had some of that already in him, right? You can see that some of his political writings, right? So, you know, the nature of humanity is just expanded and pushed forward by the nature of our technology, right?
Yeah.
But we have to believe that the future on the other side of this is going to be bright. Because here's the thing that I worry about. We've had a lot of Cassandras. We've had a lot of doomsayers. We've had a lot of people describing what the crisis points are for the last 25 years in the West. But we've had very, very few people propose solutions. Because every time a solution to a crisis is proposed, someone says, well, where are you getting that from? And then all of a sudden, no one has anything to say.
Interesting.
Well, where we can get the solutions to our leadership problems from is from the past, from people who have already gone through this.
Yeah.
That's where the solution comes from.
Yeah.
You don't need a new and improved, talk about building bridges. You don't need a new and improved way to build a bridge. You just need to look at what the Romans did. Go do that.
Yeah.
We've got it all written down. Just go pick it up and do it. Right?
Yeah.
You know, you don't need... You don't need a new understanding of how to engage with people in community and build people in community. You have examples of that
100%.
In the Bible, the Torah, the Quran. Go figure it out.
Yeah.
It's right there in front of you.
Yeah.
You know? And so the thing that is maybe stopping us, well, there's a lot of things that may be stopping us, but the thing that is helping us is that the information is right there at the tips of our fingers. Yeah. All we have to do is implement it and apply it.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing. I guess the one final question I asked to round this out kind of on that point then is, you know, there's so much information out there. We have endless choice for how to spend our time. Mm-hmm. Do you have any tips or recommendations for how someone can carve out space to make this important? To say, I want to go read War and Peace. Is there any way to try to push people, or is it just you got to decide to do it?
So I'm going to be very direct on the answer to this question, because people ask me this a lot. I read about 4 to 5 heavy, quote unquote, books a month.
Okay.
In preparation for the next podcast episodes that I'm going to be doing. And then I plan to read another 4 or 5 the month after that. We release 4 major episodes a month. So I'm reading probably 50 to 60 heavy books a year. Most people will listen to that and they'll go, I can't do that. I can't do what you're doing. And I said, you don't have to. You're not hosting a podcast. Mm-hmm. Don't do that.
Yes.
Right. I mean, do it if you love it and you want to, but you don't have to. That's not the requirement.
Don't
right?
start with that as your goal.
Don't start with that as your goal, right? Exactly. But if you genuinely want to read these books and explore these books, treat it the way you would treat an MBA program. Create an Excel file. Mm. Write down the top like 10 authors that you wanted to read that you were bored by in high school, that you didn't get anything out of.
Yes.
Because guess what? Reading Jane Austen and Sense and Sensibility at 40 will read incredibly differently than it did when you were an 18-year-old or 16-year-old or 15-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you'll have more life to bring to the game.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So make an Excel file, put down the author, put down the title, put down the Amazon link, and then just commit to buying it. Mm-hmm. I do not care, by the way, if you listen to it on Audible in your car instead of a podcast or instead of FM radio or whatever you're listening to. Or if you want to physically read the book. I personally am a favor of physically reading the book. However, with some books, I have physically read the book and listened to the Audible. That works really well with Shakespeare, by the way, because Shakespeare was meant to be performed.
Ooh,
okay,
I like that.
I do read both of those at the same time, and so I carve out a little time to do that. Yeah. Then the second thing, or the third thing maybe that I would say is, stop watching Netflix. I'm just going to be blunt and honest. Like, you know, in my household, the way we run our household, I have 4 kids. I've got a dog, I got a cat, I got a wife, I got kids, I got responsibilities, I got my businesses, I got all this, right? And yet there's still 20 minutes of my time that I could be spending watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And by the way, I do watch Netflix, don't get me wrong. Yep. But watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine reruns on Netflix when I could be reading Dune.
Yeah.
And 20 minutes in Dune is probably going to do me better than watching Andy Segura flop around a little bit. And I mean, it's funny. Like, don't get me wrong, right? I'm a huge Andre Brower fan. I think that guy was amazing. Okay. But he's performing for me. And so I'm consuming. Whereas when I'm reading Dune, I'm engaging with this thing.
Yeah.
Or when I'm reading Catherine Porter's Pale Horse, Pale Rider. Or when I'm reading Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. By the way, one of the most amazing books. It was pitched to me back when I was 18. Didn't read it. Read it now, and I'm blown away. I was like, what? The first thing I thought when I finished that book was, why didn't I read this book before?
Awesome. Excellent.
So you have to commit to making the time and restructuring your life a little bit, and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think those are all great examples of, it's lowering the bar, coming up with a deliberate plan, executing on that plan. And I think it's just one of the things that's so important about our lives today is the importance of being deliberate and because you mentioned it before, the whole world is geared towards telling you that you are losing control, that people are taking away your ability to act. They're taking away your ability to think. And if anything, your ability to think is the one thing you still have. And choosing and so thinking in a way that takes control of that. Well, hopefully a few people will take your suggestion, write down a short list. This has been really great. I know it wasn't a 3-hour discussion.
It's okay. That's all right. That's all right. There's value in these 30-minute ones. That's okay.
Different strokes for different folks.
That's right.
But this has been tremendous, Hezan. I can't thank you enough for chatting with you. And I look forward to keeping in touch.
Absolutely. Well, and Matt, thank you for the work that you're doing. I really do appreciate it. It was great to talk with you. And, I encourage your listeners to don't just listen to this episode, but actually take action. So thank you.
Absolutely. Take action. We'll link to your podcast in the show notes down below so that people can make sure to find you and then get more ideas for books that they can read. I hope you have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much for listening to today's show. If you are looking for help turning your organization's great engineers into great managers, me and my team at Better Everyday Studios would love to help. We deliver targeted and interactive training workshops that are designed to help build the 3 fundamental skills of any new manager: building trust, giving feedback, and setting goals. Reach out to me through matt@bettereverydaystudios.com so we can start making your organization better every day.